Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
That's, yeah, they have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
I'm down to Swanfield and we'll see them. What you doing down here, you shawnee man? 30-year anniversary
and you wouldn't change it one bit. That just sums up the Premier League on and off the pitch. Absolutely fantastic. Wouldn't change it for a minute. The words of Jamie Carragher in the moments after the full-time whistle was blown on a tumultuous London derby at Stamford Bridge. You're welcome to the show, everybody, and a happy 30th Premier League birthday, Ken, Murph. Happy birthday.
What a glorious day, Owen.
Thanks, Owen.
Hello there.
It's a doubly special occasion for us today because this is the first Monday Football Pod the three of us have recorded in our brand new studio. We've recently moved into our new office, and may I say, it's so nice to be able to look you both in the eye when talking, which is just how Jamie Redknapp likes it.
Just look at me when I'm talking to you. We didn't win the league for 30 years.
That was Redknapp to Gary Neville on Saturday after the Brentford-Man United match. And I can only assume Thomas Tuchel was watching that coverage and got it into his head that failing to look another person in the eye is the ultimate show of disrespect, because he felt Antonio Conte's level of eye contact during the post-match handshake was not of the required level. And all hell subsequently broke loose. So it's just lovely to be sitting across from you guys in studio. I'm able to eyeball you both intensely for the next hour and a half.
Yes, son.
Are you ready for this, Kieran?
I'm entirely ready.
It's actually quite uncomfortable. I'm going to go back and look at my computer screen. Is that okay?
Laptop's fine.
Yeah, that'll do the job. It's already been a pretty eventful Premier League season after only two games. Come to the World Service and enjoy our full coverage every week. SecondCaptains.com. £5 a month plus VAT. Just ask any World Service members in your life. I'm sure they'll vouch for how much they get out of the daily pods. We've got Dion Fanning and Laurie Whitwell on the show today after what is sure to be an action-packed Report on Sport.
Well, Alan, here we are talking about the game.
See, I love talking about the game.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those.
Redknapp telling Gary Neville to look at him while he's talking to him about Manchester
United. Shouting at him. Look at him while he's shouting at
me. I remember Wenger saying that, look at me when I talk to you.
I like that stuff.
Now, I mean, look, you can say what you like about, you know, your Jamie Redknapps, your Gary Nevilles, but it was Graeme Souness's day. It was Graeme Souness's weekend.
I mean, if you told me at 7:30 on Saturday evening that we'd be sitting here talking about a Sky Sports pundit that wasn't either Jamie Redknapp or Gary Neville, I'd have been pretty surprised.
I mean, looking for Ten Hag, by the way. Everything United have been relegated to second place on the agenda here today.
Oh, don't worry, we'll get to that.
Oh,
I'm sure.
We certainly will.
Look, I mean, we might as well. We hear Graeme Souness rejoicing in the return of all that is great about the game.
I think we've got our football back today. I think we've got our football back, as I would enjoy football. Men at it. You know, blow for a blow, and the referee letting them get on with it.
Well, the referee actually sent off both managers.
He didn't let them completely at it.
Even that I was interested in. Tuchel was, they were both sent off, but then Tuchel was allowed to wander around the pitch afterwards.
I think he just sort of ignored
I think when you're red carded, you're supposed to, even after the match, you're supposed to leave the playing area.
Well, you were being sent off. So he just,
I mean, the red card is surely, the punishment is carried forward to the next game. You know, like the tentacles of the English Premier League disciplinary system cannot extend beyond surely the final whistle of the referee.
Well, the tentacles of the disciplinary system have extended around Thomas Tuchel and have wrapped around him and are pulling him close because he's being investigated for his explosive commentary after the game about the referee, Anthony Taylor. But let's just concentrate on that sentiment from Graeme Souness. We've got our football back.
Men at it, blow for blow.
At it. Men at it. And I mean, I just love it because it is like he's expressed the sentiment in the classic reactionary terms, you know. Mm. We've got our country back.
Yes.
You know, make the Premier League great again. And it is great now. It's great because referees are ignoring fouls. That's that seems to be the logic. Yes. Basically, so the referee ignores fouls. So Chelsea were annoyed in this game, obviously, because I think Reece James was saying afterwards, look, both goals should have been disallowed. I disagree with him, actually, about the first one.
When there was a foul on Havertz.
Well, rather, I do agree with him that the goal shouldn't have happened because the referee should have enforced the rules against Havertz.
Yeah.
But having failed to do that, I don't feel as though there was enough of a case to go back and say, well, there was actually foul on Kai Havertz five minutes ago.
Gone on so long after that. Mm. The ball had gotten pinballed around a bit. At one stage, Chelsea had possession of it quite clearly and then lost it again, failed to play it out of their own box. So that's one. I never have much sympathy, to be honest, for teams who are claiming something from way back up the other end of the pitch when there's a million different things that have done wrong. Even applying the rules, you've got possession. Surely whatever phase of play has been gone past at that stage, it's relevant to the goal.
The case with Henderson on the first weekend against Fulham was a stronger case, I would have said, because, you know, the Fulham got the ball, went straight up the pitch and scored. So in this case, I don't think you can, it's like, it was a mistake by the referee, but you have to just move on from it at that point. The second one, Chelsea are obviously annoyed because clearly there was a foul by Romero on Cucurella. Yeah. And it shouldn't have been cornered to Tottenham, which they immediately scored from. It should have been a free kick to Chelsea. But it falls into the cracks of like the VAR rulings, where if they don't think it's a red card, then... Now, you could say this should be a red card. He's pulled his hair and like yanked him to the ground.
As Louis van Gaal said, in sex masochism, that's fine.
Yeah.
In all other areas of life, hair pulling, not allowed.
It's just... So, I mean,
What are you looking at me like that for?
No, it's a good memory.
I think there's a strong case.
I told you, I'm going to be looking at you all day.
Yeah, no, it's worry about that. It's quite disconcerting. Yeah. I mean, but he did say the word sex masochism in an extremely strong Dutch accent. That's the sort of thing that stays in a man's head.
There's a stronger case there. But what was interesting then was to see the joy with which... Actually, the one thing Souness didn't like was hair pulling.
Mm.
It was the one thing he had a problem with in the whole game.
Yeah.
But like the Havertz foul, right? That's clearly a foul. Yeah. So it was obviously a foul in real time. And it's not whistled because they've created a climate where we don't whistle those. We're going to let people away with those. And as Graeme Souness explained, he thought that this was...
There was the question also on that goal about whether or not there was a player in the line in Mendy's line of sight. That might have been what they were equally as annoyed about.
It's another probably debatable one.
Yeah, I would have potentially brought that into the equation.
But that's less of a manly concern.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, there's offside is offside. What we're talking about is getting our game back.
Yeah, getting our game back. Because what we don't want is simulation.
Simulation, break it down. What does it actually mean? You're cheating. You're trying to buy a foul, as someone said one day. Buying a foul, what does that mean? Oh, well, it's not really a foul, but you're hoping to get one. We don't want to see that in our game. The English game is so different to any other football. It's always been more honest and in your face and tougher and more exciting.
Is that the one thing?
So the theme of English exceptionalism, I mean, definitely is being warmed to here and continued in another... exchangers. It was Karen Carney was obviously there with Souness and Carragher, and tried to make some points about the game or some things that the players were manipulating the football, that stuff. But you know, we can hear.
What's that got to do with it?
Let's just take it away.
You saw at the end whether we don't necessarily agree with all that aggro at the end, but it happened, and that's because...
Speak for yourself.
but Conte is trying to bring that intimidation factor. His recruitments have been all 6-foot players, trying to add that, and I think that's what we've seen from this Spurs side today. They never gave up.
I think referees are letting a lot more go, and it makes for a far better watch. You know, we've all played the game. When you see simulation, people throw themselves to the ground. I've not seen that in the two games today. It's a man's game all of a sudden again. And a referee, I thought, had a fabulous game, other than something we'll point out later. But I thoroughly enjoyed both games today. That, okay, you know, if there is such a thing as a purist who watches football, might get a wee bit excited themselves when the two managers are getting upset with each other. But I'm sorry, it's professional sport. That's what it's all about. You want to win so much. Sometimes you can let go of your emotions and embarrass yourself.
It's a man's game, but as Karen points out, it's also a woman's game as well. We saw the former Chelsea captain make a few tackles in a time.
Yeah.
She would have enjoyed it out there.
There
that's
we
for
are.
Sure.
It's a man's game all of a sudden again.
I don't know if the lioness is stuck in somebody's craw over the summer.
It has been pointed out over the last 24 hours, and yesterday, that women's football did come on in leaps and bounds over the last few weeks.
Yeah.
And Karen Carney is sitting there as...
But the empire has struck back.
Women's footballer, yeah.
Men are going at it. And I always just think of in my head, that scene in Women in Love. Do you know the scene I'm talking about? The famous movie, Ken Russell, is it?
The two lads wrestling naked having eaten their dinner.
Yes.
Nice, Murph, you're on fire.
Yeah.
Great.
It is Ken Russell.
Yeah.
It's not Richard Burton, it's the other lad.
It's the great, the very great Oliver Reed.
Oliver Reed, not Richard
the
Burton.
The other lad.
Yeah. A wonderful.
The Aldi Richard Burton.
A beautiful madman, Oliver Reed. Who just whips off his clubs. Well, the two of them do, of course. Mm. Alan Bates. Mm. Mr. Bates and Mr. Reed just absolutely go at it. And if you've not seen this, I mean, it's from D.H. Lawrence, you know. Mm. And I mean, there's something about the glistening flesh, in, you know, warmed by the fire. They're doing it all in front of a roaring fire. That's just, you know, I suggest you seek it out on YouTube. But of course, they explain one of them has been to Japan or something and done some jujitsu. Mm. And so they kind of say, well, why don't we do it? Well, you can't do much in a start shirt. Well, why not strip and do it properly? And so the two men began to struggle together. Mm. They were very dissimilar. Birkin, tall and narrow, his bones thin and fine. Jared was much heavier and more plastic. His bones were strong and round. His limbs were rounded. His contours were beautifully and fully molded. He impinged upon the other man, scarcely seeming to touch him like a garment, and suddenly piercing an intense fine grip that seemed to penetrate into the very quick of Jared's being. They practiced grips and throws. They became accustomed to each other, to each other's rhythm. They got a kind of mutual physical understanding. And again, they had a real struggle. They seemed to drive their white flesh deeper and deeper against each other, as if they would break into a oneness. Birkin had a great subtle energy that would press against the other man with an uncanny force, weigh him like a spell put upon him. Then it would pass, and Jared would heave free with white, heaving, dazzling movements. So the two men entwined and wrestled with each other, working nearer and nearer, nearer to what? We wonder.
A conclusion of the wrestle. Again. It just sounds to me like two lads having a laugh.
They wrestled swiftly, rapturously, intent, mindless, alas, two essential white figures working into a tighter, closer oneness of struggle with a strange octopus-like knotting and flashing of limbs in the subdued light of the room. Kind of like the FA's disciplinary body wrapping itself around Thomas Tuchel.
Yeah.
Now and again came a sharp gasp of breath or a sound like a sigh, then the rapid thudding of movement on the thickly carpeted floor, the strange sound of flesh escaping under flesh, etc. You get the picture. Yeah. This is
basically what you're saying is Chelsea 2, Tottenham Hotspur 2.
This is our game.
In short, Chelsea 2, Spurs.
Can I just say, by the way, that the heat in this studio today, I feel like I might be getting a little bit like our friend Jared there myself.
Yeah.
I might go full. The wrestling mightn't happen, but I think some de-clothing might be about to happen soon. Ken, go on.
So, you know, this is the thing. Men going at it. That's what we want. That's what we all want, right? That's what we want. And the logic of the point is that this is going to make the Premier League better because everybody wants to see this men going at it. But is it actually, I mean, does this logic actually stand up?
Mm.
You know, it's as though, like, Souness is kind of arguing that, like, was this really needed? Is it the story that after the end of, at the 30-year mark or whatever of the Premier League, that, well, no one's watching it. The game's gone. It's a bloodless spectacle. No one really cares about it. You know, they're struggling to get the games on TV anywhere. No one's watching it around. You know, it's fallen behind all the other leagues. Is that the story?
No, Ken.
It's the opposite of that, right?
It's actually.
This just seems to me like the classic, it's classic boomer logic.
Yeah.
You know, where things have got a certain way owing to certain conditions. So you just, let's kick all those conditions away and assume that it will continue as normal. You know what I mean? My point is that this success story, which the Premier League, I guess, has been in a lot of ways, has taken place.
And happy birthday to the Premier League, by the way.
Has taken place in the context of tightening the rules in order to, well, if you can remember why that happened in the first place, it was to allow skillful players to play football as opposed to just being kicked around by not skillful players.
Mm.
Right? That was that's actually why.
It kind of reminds me of, like, you know, the it seemed like fascism made a comeback within like 2 or 3 years of the last survivors of World War II
not being able
dying.
To remember.
Yeah. And this is kind of similar. It's like the last Achilles tendon pain. You know, forwards from like the late 80s and early 90s are now sufficiently old for them to just file that aching pain in their Achilles tendon down to like, just wear and tear. Basic, you know, I'm 60 years old. It's just wear and tear. And the second that happened, within a couple of years, this was about to happen.
There is an argument here, though, Ken, that things have moved on so much in the last 30 years, football-wise, right? The technical level has moved up. The tactical level has moved up. And, you know, if you think about the early 90s, it was coming out of the 80s, and it really was quite brutal back then. I think even as kids watching, we probably would have been aware that this is actually a fairly violent sport. And certainly the World Cup in 1990, we all know that was a kind of a flashpoint in the whole thing, and everything ended up getting changed. But the point being that now, all that other stuff has moved on. There's no reason necessarily that it's just going to suddenly be literally booted out. There's maybe a happy medium that can now be hit by reintroducing a more lenient interpretation of the rules. But strengthened from a position of strength. The league is strong, yes, but maybe this is a way of allowing it to get even stronger.
I don't know. I don't understand why dispensing with the rules, which have been pretty successful in making the game faster and higher scoring, is a good thing to do. I mean, basically to bring in equalizers, which make it easier to be a player who doesn't have much ability. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, what Owen is saying, and which perhaps I even agree with, is that, you know, all of the meats of the football stew can now exist together.
Yeah.
That there's no way that you could watch Chelsea Spurs yesterday and not have enjoyed the shit out of it. I mean, it was extremely enjoyable.
I thought it was kind of ridiculous, though.
Well, what's ridiculous? Like, I know, extremely
people are like,
enjoyable.
Oh, isn't it so great? It's so great seeing Tuchel and Conte. You know, they're ridiculous.
Well,
middle-aged men losing their dignity. What's good about it? Like, I mean, this is just what's to enjoy about this?
It was.
I mean, it is. We're laughing at their expense.
Yeah, exactly. Of course, we were laughing at their expense. What's more entertaining than laughing at middle-aged men?
Yeah, you know, is it going to be
There's literally nothing better than laughing at middle-aged men making tits out of themselves?
Is it just as funny the next time? You know, or is it just like?
Well, no, but I'm just saying.
You know,
this guy doesn't even do anything.
This guy doesn't even do anything on the sideline. He just sits there. You know, he didn't wrestle the other manager. You know, they don't grapple with each other in front of the fire.
Everything in moderation. Except moderation, Kent, you know? I think that one gigantic 30-person sideline bust-up a month is probably loads.
Yeah.
I mean, once every even 2 months. I mean, it's not even that I'm being particularly greedy here. But surely the sight of a very small Italian man pointing and gesticulating in the face of a very tall German man in London, England, is exactly the sort of thing the Premier League was built upon. Come on, it's got you there. Come on.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know,
if they'd been the same height, maybe it would have been less funny.
In terms of this pantomime stuff, you know, to make it more digestible to you know, Gaelic football people.
Listen, I like what I like, and I liked that yesterday.
But in terms of what actually happens on the field, this whole let it flow, you know, fouls are fine now, is actively bad for football. I mean, it's bad, obviously, in the case of you know, when these teams have to adjust to playing the standard rules, the international rules, which they'll have to play in the World Cup or the Champions League or whatever, then. They have to remember to reset. You know, basically all the stuff that you think you can do, you can't.
That's interesting though, because I think a lot of people have, like, say, watched the Euros last summer, and saw refereeing that was actually a lot more lenient than the Premier League refereeing of the previous couple of seasons. And now there's a point to be made there. I think about the standard of refereeing. Obviously, you're getting the best European referee, so it wasn't so much that it was like a cultural decision. It was just more referees getting sort of the marginal calls correct. But it did seem like more physical contact was allowed in the Euros last season than had been allowed in the Premier League of the previous 3 or 4 years. And that's basically what's prompted this let it flow change in attitude from the Premier League?
Well, you know, they think, I mean, the idea, I suppose, is to have a higher tempo game. I mean, as the phrase let it flow implies, you know, we don't want stoppages all the time. But actually what you end up with is a slower game.
Because, are we sure that's going to happen, though? Because it hasn't happened yet. You know, it's been quite entertaining over the first couple of weeks.
Well, I mean, it's been okay. Like, I mean, the game yesterday, I didn't really think it was that good, the Chelsea talk. I mean, I didn't think it was that good a game, did you? I mean, it was fast. It was kind of, you know, it was combative.
High octane.
Yeah.
I don't think it was a classic game. But the point is that wait till see how teams adapt to the new rules. So if you're allowed foul more, teams will do that. Right. Already they do that. So there's the study that we mentioned it when we were talking to Dion and
Laurie.
The study is called The Dirty League. English Premier League provides higher incentives for fouling as compared to other European soccer leagues. Now, bearing in mind, this is with the old rules. So basically, they looked at this. These are a bunch of pointy-headed Germans, obviously. Well, it's at a university.
Oh, so can you imagine? We're going to get lectured to by the Germans.
Have any of these? Have any of these Germans, you know, played at the highest level? Daniel Memmert, I see, is this.
Make sure to mention this to Graeme Souness next time you're talking to him.
I've met Daniel Memmert. I met him at the university in Cologne, and he's a nice man, but I don't believe he ever managed at the highest level.
Sorry, you met him at the University of Cologne?
Yeah.
That's a whole other story.
I was over at the Sports University of Cologne in 2014, and Daniel Memmert, I met the man. He was talking all about neural networks at that time. Here he's just talking about fouling, and basically the study shows that the more you foul, the better you do. Right. Obviously, the trick is to foul, but not get yellow and red cards, because when you get them, they're bad. Okay. But more fouling is positively correlated with more points and positively correlated with fewer goals conceded. Right. So the more you foul, the less you tend to concede. That's a measurable trend in across European leagues, but mostly in the Premier League. This is before they changed the rules to basically say fouling is fine. So in other words, fouling now, there's even less chance of getting a yellow card. So what are you going to get? More fouls. Right, so that's what we're saying we want. Let's have more fouls, right? We've also got VAR. Now, sorry, right? But if you were in a situation where you didn't have VAR and you had this fast, furious game, men going at it all over the place, too many men for the referee to keep an eye on at once, right? The men are just at it everywhere, and there lots of stuff is happening, and it's getting through. What can you do? Let it flow, right? It's all flowing through. So it's a torrent. It's a gushing torrent of manhood. Okay, that's bad. But in this case, we can see all this stuff. We're watching it all. We can see it all. And you're going to have let it flow fouls happening in the penalty area, which, like, we've already seen that happen this season. Penalty not given. VAR doesn't give the penalty. It turns into a scandal. And what happens then is all these people going, the refs are corrupt, right? And conspiracy theories about referees. And that's literally what we can see happening with the tailored thing. I think it's just putting the referees in a really difficult position. It's basically saying, don't enforce the rules, except, you know, when obviously common sense says you have to enforce them. You know what I mean? It's impossible. It's like, it becomes an arbitrary that means injustice, right? And injustice means anger, conspiracy theory, rage. Is this what we wanted? Is this the...
Let loose the refs of war, Ken.
Like, you know, dirtier game, more teams that are saying we're going to foul more because you can. Maybe it will level things out a little bit, you know, with these little Bernardo Silva just getting kicked to the ground. You know, is that what we want? Is that apparently what we want. I don't think it's a good trend. And then I haven't even mentioned the major casualties that then sometimes result, you know, the sort of Harvey Elliotts or whatever. Poor old Harvey Elliott has internalized so much of this nonsense that he even was like sort of apologizing to like the guy who broke his leg. You know what I mean? It's like, well, look, I love playing football like that. Well,
but we're only two games into the season, Ken. Like a lot of these things, I think there's a point to be made early on. I'm glad you've staked your flag in the ground here on this one.
Yeah.
I'm not totally convinced yet, but I'll doff my cap to you come the end of the season if we're watching a really slow, plodding, late 1980s style football dominate the English game.
Yeah, well, you know, people will adapt to the rules they are given. Anyway, was there any other big stuff that happened over the weekend? Just thinking with Souness, actually, he had a big week because he got Tyrone Mings. I don't know if you saw this hit back at Souness. This was after he wrote a he wrote a thing saying, well, this is what he wrote. I won't be joining the love-in for Tyrone Mings. Oh, actually, I didn't notice the love-in.
So I didn't know. I wasn't aware there had
more
been a love-in.
Keenly attuned to that sort of thing is taking place around the place. I won't be joining the love-in for Tyrone Mings. The man, Stephen Gerrard, has stripped of the Aston Villa captaincy in a move which, summed up in one sentence, says, I just don't fancy you. Mings is well-loved in the dressing room, apparently. This is as soon as his new Daily Mail column. He's moved to Daily Mail from the Sunday Times. Well, when he appeared a couple of times on Zoom for shows we were doing on Sky Sports during lockdown, I thought, for a young man who's not achieved anything in the game, you have a hell of a lot to say. This is like a guy who's invited on the show.
I know. I think the Sky producers want him to have a lot to say. That's probably why he's there.
He's been talking about how footballers are viewed as commodities at the time. I asked him if he didn't think players were incredibly fortunate to be doing their job. He had an answer for me, of course. But that encounter told me a lot. As captain of Liverpool...
Sounds like a really good guest for one of those shows. Yeah.
Having won a great deal and captain my country, I could not have offered up an opinion in a team meeting. And if I had, there would have been Joe Fagan and Roy Moran shaking their heads and Bob Paisley pretending he didn't hear me. And it never did me any harm, he doesn't add, but, you know. Mm. I mean, that's just like, why do you have team meeting? Well, I suppose the team meeting is a kind of a team lecture or whatever.
Yeah, the team lecture.
Certainly those days it sounds
Joe,
like
Ronnie and Bob. You know, tell you what's what, and you, including the 30-year-old captain, sits there. So now it seems like an affront when this Tyrone Mings, who hasn't, you know, what's he ever done?
You're also not his manager, though, I suppose, Graham. You know, at the end of the day, you're just two people on a Sky Sports podcast or whatever.
Filling out some COVID content.
Yeah.
I know. And getting annoyed because he seems to have too much to say on the podcast.
Yeah. All right, sorry, can I speak here? Excuse me. I only retired 40 years ago.
Tyrone Mings.
Someone needs to hear from me.
What a weird article. That Zoom call I was invited on was 2 years ago and he said nothing to me at the time. Now he wants to drag me into his pointless column. By the way, I've achieved plenty from where I started. Happy to chat things through if you ever need me. Thumbs up. So that's Tyrone Mings. It was all coming up Tyrone Mings this weekend because he was obviously dropped by Stephen Gerrard and de-captained. Mm-hmm. You know, his epaulets were torn off and his sword was broken and all this, and pretty humiliating.
Give me the epaulet that you've tucked in your sock, Mings.
He's straight.
The spare one. And the other one. And come on.
And yet, having not played in that game, which they lost to Bournemouth, he was straight back into the team. Alongside new signing Diego Carlos, who's ruptured his Achilles. So it looks like Tyrone Mings is once again indispensable to this. Carlos ruptured his Achilles in the game against Everton, which obviously the Gerrard Lampard showdown. How they must hate each other. Just well, like they never be free of each other, just constantly. Mm. But yeah, it was not a great game. What else was happening? Was there anything else?
Stop teasing, Ken. Come on.
Well,
give the crowd what they want.
I mean, where do you start with that? Where do you start with this?
Maybe
this
the first goal, Brentford. And then the second goal, and then possibly followed by the third. And you could even
well, you start
the
before
fourth.
You start before the first goal because Brentford immediately were, you know, you're kind of looking at it. This is another awkward team for them to play. You know, United have not been lucky in terms of the way that the fixtures have.
Ah, awkward. Come on, it's fucking Brentford, like.
Yeah, I know.
I know what you're going to say. They're a very well-drilled team. They have a system. Same as Brighton, but so are a lot of teams in the Premier League. You can't exactly say it's a nightmare fixture list.
Well, like, I mean, for instance, City's fixture list: West Ham and then Bournemouth.
Yeah,
United probably would have won those.
Okay, but
games,
United could have had they could have had City and then Liverpool. You know what I mean?
Oh, they have Liverpool next.
Yeah. Okay. After two matches that they shouldn't be losing 2-0 and 4-0.
It's amazing. Yeah. They've got
it was 2-1.
Got a manager. 2-1. Manager with a half a brain, as Roddy Collins would say.
And you see,
is that basically what we're saying?
It's. I mean, you see Thomas Frank after the game. You know, his eyes glittering. You know, like this is a career triumph. Like this is the kind of result that gets you a bigger job. You know, down the line. But for Ten Hag, you're just looking at this. How can you let this happen? I mean, how could they not have acted earlier in the game? You could see what was happening, you know? So the first goal comes from them trying to play out. And already you can see what Brentford are going to do. They're just like all over. They're just like, okay, we think you're going to pass it here. So we're going to run to arrive there at the same time the ball does. And we're going to try and win the ball. And they ended up forcing United or giving away a throw just by the corner flag. Because Maguire was kind of charged down. And then the throw, everyone is marked. So Dalot, I think, taking the throw, like throws it really far to Ronaldo, who's like, you know, there's seven Brentford players sort of around the ball. Ronaldo then gets it, thinks he's fouled, but let it flow. And suddenly Brentford, you know, the United team is all over that side. Brentford get it across, De Silva shot, and then De Gea just, I mean, De Gea throws it in, right? So that was like, De Gea still needs to stop it. The second one happens like, what, 8 minutes later. And it's the same thing. And, no, but it also, it's not just, remember what happened. It was playing out. The ball comes to Maguire. Maguire's standing there with the ball. And like the game, he's come to a total stop. And it's like, where am I going to go with this ball? And he's kind of gesticulating to people, oh, why isn't it? You're thinking, why is there no one out there to the side for him to, you know, there's no one for him, obviously, to pass it to. And he ends up losing it. Did he try to pass it forward and it's cut out? But what happened then was Brentford then go straight through the middle. Maguire runs back and chops the guy down. What could have been a red card, you know, if Martinez had been slightly different position. So they get a free kick, which they knocked over the bar. But the really dangerous set piece to Man United is their own goal kick. And this is where they then, you know, and just, but how can this happen? Like when you've seen it, somebody, you've seen it already happen several times in the game. You're like, okay, we need to change what we're doing here quickly to try and stop this pattern of what's happening. Like, they have to do that. And if the players aren't doing it, if the players aren't thinking this themselves, then Ten Hag has to be down screaming at them. I mean, we've seen Ten Hag scream at players, you know, during the, remember the, there was footage of him in one of the preseason games screaming at De Gea, David, what the fuck are you doing? This was at De Gea. Yeah. Who had just booted a ball clear, right? So maybe De Gea is thinking, oh, you know, I don't want him to be angry. I hate him when he's angry. But again, just this ridiculous, like, slow kicking the ball out and everyone's sort of standing there and like, what are you doing? To Eriksen, who's marked, and then bang, it's a goal. And you're like, okay, well, that's game over. Now it's game over. But it's also game over thanks to what we've done to ourselves. And, I mean, I just don't understand how... There isn't this sort of a more basic, I'm now doing a Graeme Souness on it. How can you not say, look, we need to get through the next 5-10 minutes without conceding a goal and try and play into
play
this?
Play some territory.
I can only think.
Try to play some territory.
Absolutely. That's what Brentford would do.
They would, absolutely. As Thomas Frank happily explained afterwards, he was, as you're saying, I like those interviews with winning managers against bigger teams.
Oh, the victory lap is so good.
Let me tell you how he did
that. I'll try to be humble about this, but really I'm not going to try to be too humble at all. Yeah. But the only thing I presume is that Ten Hag is trying to stamp his authority, his style of play, getting everyone to buy into it. And somewhere in his head, he's thinking, if I abandon that because we're under a bit of pressure and 1-0 down in a match early on and say, okay, actually forget about everything we did pre-season, let's batten down the hatches, I'm going to lose respect for me and for my game plan. That could be it.
Yeah, I mean, but at the same time, so I think you're also going to lose respect for you and your game plan when you completely ineptly execute the game plan and lose 4-0 to Brentford, concedes four
this
goals in 25
this
minutes.
This is the issue. And for all the, and people are, you know, nobody's really hammering Ten Hag yet, but you can, and I'm sure most Manchester United fans would take, I don't know, I presume you'd like take a sixth or seventh place or something if there's some progress there, potentially some players regaining form, all that kind of stuff. But like Ten Hag's not going to get that far if he keeps losing 4-0 to, admittedly, Ken, incredible opposition like Brentford.
No, and I think you have to also take into account, like, is this practical? Can I do this with these players? And I feel like with the team he picked against Brentford, it's really not, right? Ronaldo is up front. I mean, there's a lot of stuff happening with Ronaldo at the moment. We'll talk about it with Laurie. Conflicting reports about him. I kind of feel like he's probably not going to be there, but you know, we'll wait and see. I mean, he's surprised me by being there this long. But obviously, he's not going to. You can't sort of do any kind of pressing with him. I mean, you can't. It's sort of denying reality. Can you play this way with David De Gea as your goalkeeper? I don't think you can.
No,
I don't think he can't do it. And Ten Hag after the game saying, "Oh, he can do it. I've seen him do it in training." Well, he can't do it, right? Maybe he's training against your players. Right, if he was training against Matthias Jensen and Brentford, then maybe the flaws would start to become more barren here. Who's actually supposed to be closing down?
He's an absolute dinger getting past the Ronaldo press every day.
I did feel a little bit sorry for De Gea in that. That was a bad touch by Eriksen by his standards. I know it's not a ball you should be receiving where he was with a player behind him, but if Christian Eriksen received that ball in midfield, you'd be expecting him to turn and knock it away. But it just showed up very early in the season that De Gea, of course, he's not a passing goalkeeper.
No.
He's not going to suddenly become one at this stage of his career.
No, he's the least passing goalkeeper in the league.
Statistically?
Yes. He's the last season, no keeper attempted fewer passes than De Gea. No keeper made fewer sweeper keeper outside the box interventions than De Gea, right? He's the most traditional.
He's
most
Pat Jennings, basically.
He's a table football on defend the line. You know, shot stopping goalkeeper, right? It's before the back pass rule, right? Was invented.
Pat Jennings with gloves. Mm. Did Pat Jennings have gloves? Can't quite.
Only
remember.
On very wet days.
Yeah.
That I mean, and
De Gea, cotton jobs.
De Gea is also a brilliantly gifted player, and this is what makes it difficult, really. I think with De Gea, you know, to accept that, like, if you want to play this way, you're not going to be able to do it with him.
Is Caoimhín Kelleher the answer?
Caoimhín Kelleher would be the answer. Gavin Bazunu would be a better option for Man United. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Caoimhín Kelleher, I think, would be better. I mean, is he as good a goalkeeper as David De Gea? I mean, remains to be seen. Probably not.
Bazunu's conceded 6 goals so far. That might be a hard sell for Man United.
Well,
fans.
So was De Gea. You know, so
I know, but let's replace him with another. Anyway, listen, don't think anyone's going to leave Liverpool to go to United, and Bazunu, that's the job at hand.
But my, the question here is, Is Ten Hag going to recognize and deal with this? Or is he just going to kind of stick his fingers in his ears and go, let's hope this is all right on the night? Because if he does the second, it's not going to work, and it's going to be brief, right? This is going to be a brief story. And the other thing is obviously it's the De Jong situation. I mean, he came on for Barcelona. They drew their opening match of the season, 0-0. He came on and obviously improved the team. Is he going to end up at Man United? I mean, it's looking less likely, I feel. Like, obviously, United think, yes, they believe that he might join, but so do Chelsea. Someone is getting lied to.
Please, Frankie, come to the club where literally no one's career has been improved by joining.
But how long can
for
that
the last
continue?
10 years. How long? I will be the man to save Manchester United.
How long can that continue?
It's the sort of thing an egotistical footballer might take. Yes.
We've got a new regime here in place. The rules have changed.
The Manchester black hole.
Yeah.
The Manchester career black holes.
Yeah,
you don't even call the Manchester United anymore.
Let's see how your press resistance works out, and you know, in Let It Flow, right? You know, like let's see what you've got. But he needs to decide about that as well, right? Because if they get to the end and it hasn't happened, and they haven't got anyone else, then again, you know, it's like, well, this is just going to be really.
He could
really
resign
difficult.
On September 2nd, head held high. I tried to manage Manchester United, I failed, and he'll be PSG manager within 6 months.
But he's already looking.
If I was Eric Ten Hag, that's what I'd do. I'd resign on the September the 2nd. If they don't sign like 8 players. Because like they need 8 players.
In the lookalike stakes with yours truly, he's already starting to look like he's added 1 or 2 years, even over the first couple of weeks. Eric Ten Haggard.
Yeah.
I suggest.
3 more months of this one, he'll look exactly the same as you.
Nice.
8 touches, of course, just for Erling Haaland. This was a valiant attempt on Romelu Lukaku's record, although he only had 74 minutes on the pitch. Lukaku, was Lukaku out there for the whole game?
I believe so.
That was against Palace, and they won 1-0. Chelsea won 1-0, whereas City won 4-0. 4-0.
Declared it 4.
A pretty handsome victory. Mark Travers started well, made a good save from Foden, and then, of course, there was probably a few too many shots to deal with, really.
Yeah, it was slightly a fall for one goal, but he still made a few decent saves in the second. I don't think he'd pin this one on Travers. Haaland did get an assist. He hadn't touched the ball for the first 20 minutes nearly, and then gets a lovely assist for
that sort of Balotelli style, almost falling over, little feed the ball into the path of the onrushing player. Balotelli's only assist for Man City was the one for Aguero. But it's 8 touches. It's kind of comical, but obviously the reason is because of Bournemouth basically playing a box of 10 players in the area where he was supposed to be on the pitch all the time. So it's like Guardiola said, well, I mean, he's supposed to be there. If he there's no point in him actually coming out of there because, you know, all their players are still going to be there. So sometimes this happens. Hasn't happened before with it's the lowest passes, I think, for any Man City player ever. But, you know, it's just one of those things. Everyone was expecting him to score 4 goals against Bournemouth. And I guess
those was broadcasting it on television, Ken, and building it up pre-match. We're hoping for more than just 1 assist from Erling Haaland, I'll tell you that. But at the same time, there was a lot to admire in the Man City performance.
And more than one touch for every 10 minutes that he was on, or part of 10 minutes that he was on the field.
There was one bit during where Foden got in, you know, that position where Man City players always cut it back, even before they have this recognised striker. And Foden shot, and actually Travers made a really good save on it. But Haaland was fuming, just jumping up and down. And Pep said afterwards,
that was right at the beginning.
Travers said. And Pep said afterwards, they have to know Erling's in there.
Always going to be there.
He's always going to be there. Just kick the ball into him.
Yeah. Give it to him, and he will be there. The other thing, just which is worth noticing, Arsenal again, another great win. And another brilliant performance by Jesus, 2 goals, 2 assists. And Martinelli looking really good as well. He scored in both games. Gabriel Jesus' quotes to ESPN Brazil. I feel like I'm back to being the Gabriel from before, thinking I'm the number 9. I'm there to finish, to help, to not only score goals as well. I'm back. As I've said before, I'm a little bit like a Varzea player, which translates, I guess, as a sort of a casual Sunday player or whatever. I'm not a robot that stays put. I want to move. I want to fight. I want to compete. Today, I almost scored with a great ball from Aaron Ramsdell. I fought and almost got the goal. That is the Gabriel, the Gabriel. But just, I mean, obviously, what's interesting about it is just the suggestion that, like, from before you joined Man City, I'm not a robot.
Yeah, says. the nightmare 4 years at Man City where he won 3 leagues.
Well, he's not a robot anymore, and he's, Arsenal are. Are feeling the benefit.
It happened to be on the dart.
It's time to get busy with this motherfucker.
Like we always do about this time.
Okay, I'm going to reveal a piece of information now as well. I haven't smoked a cigarette in 4 days.
So what I'm saying is to this guy, cheer up. How about you wake up?
Last time I took the dart, I was over to split.
Wake up. Wake up to what's happening in the world.
Hey, Pat, do you want a spliff?
Well, on this, the 30th anniversary of the birth of the Premier League, this special occasion, we've got two special guests for you. The Currency's Dion Fanning. Hey, Dion.
Hey, Owen, how's it going?
And Laurie Whitwell, who covers Manchester United for The Athletic. Laurie, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Good, good. An action-packed weekend, Dion, I'm sure you can say, on and off the field. Will we start with... Well, we have our football back, according to Graeme Souness. Oh, I'm not quite sure what exactly that means. But what did you make of the scenes at the end of the Chelsea-Spurs game?
I think, like everybody, including Graeme Souness and Jamie Carragher, I thought they were tremendous. Great scenes. I think with managers, nobody, it's just lip service is paid to the idea that we don't want to see this kind of thing. It's so half-hearted when people say it, because clearly it's exactly what we want to see. Like there is no downside to managers being sent off. Like there is nothing, like, you know, you can get a red card in a match and you think that's entertaining, but it now ruins the game or whatever. Whereas managers being sent off, it's just it improves the game. Yeah, so it was just part of, you know, I think Graeme Souness was just the adrenaline, the combination of you know, the 30th anniversary, just putting all of this into context, and the fact that it was such an adrenaline fueled weekend. I think he was just overcome with the with sort of the love for our Premier League, our league, as he kept calling it. And he just reminded me of somebody. It's like, you know, during the kind of Queen's Jubilee or something, when you interview somebody outside Buckingham Palace and they're just weeping with love for the monarchy. Like that's where Souness was, I think, on Sunday.
But is this the game that you grew up watching, doing hair pulling, middle-aged men, yeah, going at each other and getting sent off?
Is this those two?
I mean, Souness was being nostalgic about it, as though this is the way things used to be. I can't remember those types of things ever happening.
Well, no, what I think is interesting in that regard is that I think there's a kind of there's an escalation. Like I think the Premier League has always had this element of soap opera. And that terrible word, but narrative attached to it too. And it to remain, it's almost like it does it kind of organically, but to remain compelling, it always has to kind of expand its horizons in terms of what those narratives are going to be. And in a way, and this isn't the two incidents you mentioned don't really fall into that, but this idea that they're going to keep the game flowing is a kind of almost a way of developing that too, because it's such a ludicrous idea really when you analyze it, that, you know, we're going to let some fouls are not actually going to be considered fouls. It's an absurd point of view to have, but in a way it creates this sort of energy around the Premier League, which makes it compelling. And I was watching, you know, when I like when Souness was going on yesterday, I was kind of thinking, he kind of has a point. Like, not in terms of like there's no league like this, nobody, people have to be ready for our league in a way that they wouldn't be ready for any other league. But that commitment to the storyline is something that has kept the Premier League at the top for a lot longer than any other league. Whether it stays there, I don't know, but it has actually kept it at the top in terms of being a compelling attraction. It has done that for longer than other leagues. That, you know, Carragher mentioned Souness's time in Serie A last night, and you know that those leagues faded in a way that the Premier League hasn't. And maybe it's because of these things. It says, and I don't, you know, I didn't grow up watching managers doing that, but you know, I remember being at Stamford Bridge for the John Terry Wayne Bridge handshake. You know, like, did I grow up waiting to see if two players who may or may not have been involved in whose private lives may have overlapped in certain ways? Did I grow up watching that kind of football? No, I didn't. But at the same time, that day at Stamford Bridge, it was the thing that everyone was there to kind of talk about. So it's always had this element that and reinvents itself in terms of what those details are, but that element has always been there.
So, like, do you agree with Dion's point of view here, which, if I can summarize it, is people like wrestling, the Premier League should be more like wrestling.
And it's a very fair synopsis of what Dion was saying, Ken. I loved it, though. Didn't everyone? Because, you know, we've had, you know, a long summer where there's been no football because of a lovely Winter World Cup coming up, but you know, we're back. This is what it's about, right? You know, two proper managers going at it on the sidelines. And each time you thought that the story of the day was over, you know, like, so you kind of thought that, okay, Tuchel running down the touchline, that was the kind of the exclamation mark on this touchline rivalry. Then you get the extra bit, then you get the full-time whistle and this kind of Strictly Come Dancing twist and turn as the handshake is kind of gripped onto by Thomas Tuchel, and you've got to look him in the eye when you shake someone's hand. Do you always look somebody in the eye when you shake their hand? I mean, I guess that is a usual social prerequisite. But I just thought it was great fun. I kind of wanted more replays. I did kind of wonder what the trigger was, though, because I think the first bit of Conte going over and celebrating the equaliser, he was kind of directing it at somebody else in the Chelsea back room. I don't know if this got cleared up without me realising, but then Tuchel kind of comes and defends his guy and gets right up in his grill, which, I don't know, I kind of quite like. People say that they're actually friends or that they kind of respect each other off the pitch. But then you also have the Instagram post from Conte, which is obviously the modern era of how these things continue. You know, a Premier League manager making an Instagram story or whoever does it on his behalf. Sort of continuing to pour the fuel on the flames, I suppose. But I did kind of think, you know, in terms of the nostalgia element, I mean, didn't we have Paul Gascoigne grabbing Vinnie Jones
by the way around, but yes.
Other way around, sorry. And you know, Roy Keane stamping on Gareth Southgate, that's a bit more aggressive. But, you know, we've had these kind of flashpoints where these kind of crazy episodes. I suppose that doesn't quite translate to them managers acting it out. But I guess these are two guys that want to show their dominance of their coaching abilities, their managerial abilities at two big clubs where the pressure's on. I guess they kind of both felt they had to perform a role there.
But what do you think, though, of the basic underlying logic of what, say, Souness was saying, or Carragher afterwards, was the referees are letting a lot more go, right? And it's clear, like, you know, watching the game so far this season, you can push someone over from behind now, it's not foul. You know,
That was a penalty, wasn't it? Earl Trafford.
That was the most sort of blatant one. But this kind of thing's been happening the whole time. Is this actually a good trend? I mean, the referees are ignoring what are fouls. I mean, I saw in the Athletic this morning. I can't remember which piece it was in, but someone had referred to a study in Germany where they found essentially the more fouls you commit, the fewer goals you concede. More fouls means fewer goals. How is this better?
Good study. I need to go and read my own website, don't I, for that one.
It was in the Chelsea. It's in the Chelsea section.
There we go. Yeah, I've got enough on my plate with Man United at the moment to go elsewhere. I mean, I don't know. I always I'm intrigued by your interpretation of certain fouls, Ken, because I love how granular you get with things. Because I thought that Bentancourt one on Havertz, I could see why he didn't give that. I mean, it probably is a foul, but I can equally, I'm not like so vexed about it that I'm, you know, like a Chelsea supporter is saying how, you know, Anthony Taylor can never referee our matches again. I kind of felt like it was kind of close. Okay, the hair pulling on Cucurella just should have been a foul, shouldn't it? Like, it's clear. So that goal shouldn't have stood, the second one, but I don't know.
Should have been a red card, though, because that's the reason why they sort of don't do anything. Obviously, it's a foul, but VAR can't just give a foul. Like, they don't just give free kicks. Like, say if it had been the other way around, they could have given a penalty for that. But the only way that they can intervene there, I guess, is if they say, actually, this has to be a red card against Romero. Do you think it was a red card? I mean, to pull someone's hair like that, I mean, is it a red card? I mean, it seems like it probably should be.
Yeah, I mean, is it violent conduct? It's pretty aggressive, isn't it? And the way, I suppose, the manner of it. I'm trying to think if we had hair pulling incidents like that. I know people.
I remember Luis Suarez pulled the hair of one of the Man United twins.
Yes. Yeah.
And there was a Fellaini with the sex masochism incident with Declan Hall, I think was Fellaini's hair. So it's always these curly headed players who get victimised by this.
They're asking for it. I mean, we had Hannibal Mejbri, who's a young player at United. He was playing 21s games last season and he was getting his hair pulled. And to kind of rectify the matter, he kind of pinned it up and did it in a little bun. So, you know, I mean, it does seem a little bit unfair that you've kind of got to temper your hairdo depending on who might be your opponent. But I suppose, you know, someone like Romero, it was literally the most Romero thing, you know, he could have done. He is this, you know, poster boy for dark arts of defending, isn't he? So he's obviously, I mean, you put Cucurella against him, he's obviously shorter than him anyway, Cucurella, so it seemed a bit of a mismatch. But then also, you've got this guy with long frizzy hair against this guy that will literally do anything to get an upper hand. He's obviously going to pull his hair. So I'm not saying that's Thomas Tuchel's fault for putting them up against each other, but it was I suppose you might consider that in future. But I don't know. I don't think you can get a red for that. That would seem harsh to me to get a red. So therefore, I guess the VAR can't intervene, right?
Dion, Laurie referred there to the Chelsea fans saying Anthony Taylor can never referee another Chelsea game. We need to campaign on this. The man is corrupt. And we have to do something about this. You see all these Chelsea supporters around the world doing videos about how, you know, everyone can see this, the corruption is so blatant, we've got to stop it. You must think this is a good development. This all adds to the narrative richness of the league. Supporters are convinced that referees are not just incompetent but actually corrupt.
Yeah, I think, you know, we can sometimes enjoy the entertainment while fearing the consequences. And it's not just the Chelsea fans. Tuchel said that Anthony Taylor should be banned from refereeing future Chelsea games. So it isn't. I don't think it's just people sitting in their bedrooms making videos who are saying this. And it seems like I agree with Laurie. Like I didn't see the kind of massive injustice that Chelsea latched onto in the aftermath as you know. I didn't just see it. I didn't see it in the game. I thought, like, the goals, you know, you could make a case for the goals not being given, but they weren't egregious miscarriages of justice that mean that, you know, this campaign is justified. And I think it is. Like, the one thing, the one area, like, there are many areas where VAR has kind of failed, but the one area where I really hoped it would make a difference would be that it would end huge post-match analysis of refereeing decisions, and was this a penalty or was this not, and clearly it hasn't. And it is the most uninteresting element, I think, of kind of football analysis, like just going over incidents. I think BT Sport especially would do it a lot with you know, Jake Humphrey it seems to be it's something he loves to analyse. Hours seemingly disappear as they analyse penalty decisions. And it clearly there's a reason why they're doing that, because it's the stuff that supporters get worked up by and feel aggrieved by. But it's
also because the referees now are clearly ignoring
video evidence. It's not just, oh, I didn't see that. It's, yeah, I've had a look at that and it's fine. Previously, a referee could say, oh, I missed the incident. But now it's like, no, we've decided to ignore that because we're corrupt. It's the logic. You know, that's I think this is something actually that's kind of inherent to VAR. It's like it takes away the alibi of, yeah, so, you know, I've only got one pair of eyes. Now it's like we're all watching this and we've just waved that one through because we want your team to lose.
Yeah, well, I think that's what happens with the Romero incident as well, because people think, well, you know, this should have been picked up, and then it's the detail, the fact that, you know, they can't intervene unless it's a sending off. Now, I actually, this may or may not be a good argument for the idea that he should have been sent off, but I did read Peter Walton today saying that Romero should have been sent off for that hair pull. Now, given Peter Walton's track record, people might think that that's, you know, it wasn't a sending off at all, but it could have led to that. And yeah, and it does create a sense of, it does help create that sense of victimhood and conspiracy if there's also video and things are ignored. But I do think that's the way things have gone as well, not just in football but in the world, where there is very few situations, no matter how much factual evidence appears to be on one side, there is very little situation that doesn't become polarizing and divisive.
Well, the idea that the first goal should be disallowed for a foul that happened up the other end of the pitch, after which Chelsea got the ball back twice and gave it away, like, well, you know, once it just bounced off one of their players, but they recovered possession at another point and then gave it away again. It's, you know, it's whatever, 45 seconds later the goal is scored, is absolutely ridiculous. But as you're saying, Dion, we don't get bogged down in each of these individual decisions. I do want to ask you about Spurs here and what's going on under Conte this season. They say themselves, Harry Kane said, look, we didn't actually play very well, we probably didn't deserve a point, but we got one. And that's exactly the kind of point you might have imagined them not getting in the pre-Conte era.
Yeah, like Chelsea were much better for most of the game. And again, it is interesting how, because of the summer that Tottenham had and the time Chelsea have had, not just since the summer, but obviously since Russia invaded Ukraine, that the sense has been, okay, here Spurs are on the march and are going to kind of overtake Chelsea. But the kind of core quality in Chelsea and the progress that's still required by Conte was there to be seen in the general play. But as you say, the fact that they did then get a point allows people to believe that maybe this is something different under Conte. But I still think there's probably a way to go. Although, you know, again, the new signings were on the bench. They will come into it. Richarlison made a big difference when he came on. And it was an ideal game for him, I think, just because there was that competitive edge. But I still think there's a good bit of work to do for Tottenham to actually come close to Chelsea are still that team who kind of, and they did this last season as well, where they began the season very well and actually looked like, on the back of the Champions League, that they were really going to challenge Liverpool and Manchester City. But it didn't happen. Now maybe this season Chelsea can sustain that, although the circumstances, you know, it isn't going to be the Abramovich era. But I still think there's enough quality there, and the signings they've made means that they've got a better chance than Spurs.
Laurie, can you remind me again why? Remind us all, why is Antonio Conte not managing Manchester United at the moment?
Can you imagine Antonio Conte at Manchester United? You know, in this current era of indecisiveness and inability to get deals done.
I know, but maybe he would have been the personality they needed. Maybe he would have had the transformative effect, so they wouldn't be stuck.
Spurs were in a pretty bad way when he took over there, and he seems to have whipped them into line pretty fast.
Yeah, yeah, but they've got Paratici, haven't they, who is an experienced sporting director with connections, you know, was able to get Kulusevski and Bentancur in through those connections. You've got Daniel Levy, who, okay, you can criticise various decisions he's made in his career, but, you know, can also, he does know a lot of people in football and can get deals done. I just think that Conte would have come into United, you know, torn his hair out, you know, he's... his well-paid-for hair out pretty quickly, and you know, it would have ended in disaster. I'm sure of it. Whereas here, there was an element of end of last season where Conte was putting pressure on the Spurs board to get signings in. And I think there was a sort of summit tour, wasn't it, at the end of last season. And the result of that was, no, we will get signings in quickly. That was what he was told. And then actually, you know, Tottenham delivered. You know, the signings that they've made all look pretty sensible. I know there's a bit of conflict maybe over the Jed Spence thing because he's got Emerson Royale and Matt Doherty there to cover that spot. And you know, maybe that was a club signing rather than him. But equally at the same time, he's got Perisic. He's got Richarlison. I mean, you look at the substitutions that he was able to make to try and get Spurs back into that game. Yeah, they weren't playing well and they probably, you know, they didn't deserve a point, did they? But he was still able to kind of change the system and put a Premier League player on who has got, you know, a good scoring record in Richarlison. You know, United just aren't at that level at the moment.
Yeah. There was a story reported everywhere yesterday, which sounded like fan fiction, like some kind of revenge fantasy. And it was that Erik ten Hag cancelled Manchester United's day off and made everybody run 13.8 kilometres because that's how much further Brentford ran than them. Even Ronaldo had to run 13.8 kilometres, you've reported today. I mean, yeah. That is, what do you make of the situation? I mean, the fact that, like, it seems like one of the most galling things for United fans that this happened in the first place. And I don't mean what Ten Hag has done, but I mean that they ran like 95 kilometers or something in the game. Like it's the most basic indicator of our team just doesn't try as hard as other teams.
Yeah, and that's what Ten Hag is furious over. You know, pre-season, that was something that looked like was happening at United. He was happy with what was going on. And now, you know, we can probably discuss the Ronaldo aspect to it, Ken. I'm sure you've got some thoughts on that. But it is interesting. And yeah, he was on the bench for the first half against Brighton. But it is interesting that his, you know, his return to the starting lineup has kind of seen this fall in running stats. And I think Ten Hag's made the decision to go old school. We're talking about nostalgia early, weren't we? You know, this is a very kind of old school method to get your players in, running, just kind of make that point. And I think Ten Hag probably thinks, I'm in a real difficult position here already, two games into his tenure. I have to make this kind of point right now, otherwise I'm never going to get a chance to. So, you know, he's got the players in, you know, whether they ultimately respond to it, we'll see. But I think the Ronaldo aspect is probably the biggest thing for him to deal with at the moment. I think we report this morning that, you know, the original idea that he wanted to keep Ronaldo has waned once Ronaldo's in the building. Ronaldo, I think, has, you know, the options for him to leave have seemed to go away. But by the same token, I think he still ultimately wants to. You know, there's that Champions League goals record plus some group stage goals against Lionel Messi that he wants to overtake. So, you know, this is a season for that, obviously. And I think ultimately Ten Hag probably thinks now that actually, if we can somehow, you know, let Ronaldo leave, sell him somewhere, I don't even know if they necessarily, he feels like he would want to have to replace him. I think he just feels like get back to that pre-season squad where everyone was on the same page and listening to my instructions, because as far as we're told, Ronaldo has shown some resistance to the pressing instructions that Ten Hag's delivered.
Well, Laurie, this is the line that really stood out in your piece about this. The Atlantic has been told that those who eat lunch alone at the Cantina Carrington while he has been seen flapping his arms about in training and attempting to argue against the high-pressing approach favoured by the new manager. That's like the most basic principle of what Ten Hag is trying to do. And the highest profile player in the squad apparently is arguing after one or two matches of the season that, like, that's a completely untenable situation. Like, there was a report yesterday, Sky report, and I don't know if they were just sort of following what they saw in the Times, but their report, which they then sort of deleted the tweet of, it was saying that United are thinking about kind of cancelling Ronaldo's contract. Paul Hurst in the Times said, you know, his demeanour is said to be worsening the atmosphere, with one source describing the Portugal forward as a walking bad mood. So the idea was that maybe they might just sort of unilaterally say, look, this isn't working, and pay him off. Sky obviously couldn't stand it up, and United, I think, have denied it, but those stories don't come out of thin air.
No, yeah. United denied it strongly, you know, he's not for sale, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, I guess they have to. Like, what else can they do? Certainly, as far as our understanding is, that is a decision that is being considered. I don't know if they actually would get to that point as a club, whether they think that actually, you know, it all goes back to Joel Glazer, doesn't it? He will ultimately make that call, really, which sounds crazy because he's the owner and really should delegate that to the people on the football side. But, you know, he has the control of the finances. And if he thinks that Cristiano Ronaldo is an asset to Manchester United for whatever reason, commercially, then that ultimately is a decisive factor in what happens. You could also say, though, that by keeping Ronaldo and, you know, the mood, as Paul Hurst has described, that's the same thing that I've heard, that he is, as we've said in the piece, you know, eating lunch alone. I know that sounds like a minor point, but he's kind of cutting an isolated figure. He's obviously making it clear that he doesn't want to be here. So, you know, is that then having a knock-on effect for the values of other players if they're not showing their full self? You know, we looked in pre-season. I know it's pre-season, and as Roy Keane says, fine until the real action starts, but... you know, Rashford looked like a sharp player again. Sancho looked on it. You know, even Anthony Martial. But Anthony Martial's a slightly different kettle of fish because, you know, he hasn't shown that consistently enough, I don't think. But, you know, you had some sprouts of encouragement, I suppose. And so their values by looking like they did on Saturday evening, you know, footballers, you know, who would buy those guys at the moment? You know, their values are decreasing. So you have to take the... Surely United have to take a holistic approach and think, well, you know, fine, Ronaldo has a certain value, but do other players not also have value? And is his remaining at United going to have an effect on that?
I think it's kind of incredible from Ten Hag's point of view and from the sort of trying to analyse what Ten Hag is planning that, as Laurie said, that he's changed his mind on Ronaldo. Because, like, you do, when you read that, you're going, like, what due diligence did he do? Like, what was he not paying attention?
It's like he liked the idea of Ronaldo or something.
Yeah, suddenly when he encountered him, he's like, hold on, this isn't what I expected at all. Like, it's exactly what everyone else expected. And again, you know, when you, like, Ten Hag is there and it's like the idea that's coming out, you know, this is one of the worst situations he's ever encountered. Of course it is. Like, it is. This is what Manchester United has been. If you paid attention to last season, you would have known, and you would have surely realised that there's really strong, swift action needed to be taken. Now, I know that that's not the way United have moved in the transfer market. Isn't down to him, but again, it's just he hasn't helped in that sense of kind of confusion. And Ronaldo really points to that. Like, the idea that you would suddenly go, like, God, I've realised we can't. Ronaldo isn't going to work in this pressing game at all. When that should be obvious. The idea that somehow you can bend Ronaldo's will to what you want is either massively narcissistic and egotistical, or just idiotic. But it's just never going to happen. You know, Ronaldo is Ronaldo, for better and for worse, and Ten Hag isn't going to change that. So, and what that then tells you about how he's going to, whether he's going to succeed or fail at Manchester United in general, I think is a critical point as well. Because if you're that wrong about that key decision, what else are you going to be wrong about?
Well, maybe he's wrong about trusting his goalkeeper to be able to implement his passing out from the back style, because it certainly backfired spectacularly at the weekend. Laurie, I'm reading a very cogent writer in the Irish Times named Ken Early, who says after Brentford, it's clear that Ten Hag is going to have to choose between his system and his goalkeeper. Obviously, everybody's been talking about Ronaldo. That's been hanging over the whole summer. But is David De Gea, for all his strengths, the exact wrong type of goalkeeper for Erik Ten Hag to have in this Manchester United team?
Yeah, I think that is a real interesting area, and it has kind of gone under the radar because, you know, David De Gea was the player's player of the season last year, and, you know, you kind of think, okay, that seems like an okay situation. We've got a goalkeeper that can stop, you know, balls going in the net. But, you know, we spoke to David De Gea in pre-season after we saw him play against Liverpool in that friendly in Bangkok, and he came out of his goal, you know, way more frequently than you'd been used to. It was clear that was kind of an instruction. So we asked him, you know, do you feel comfortable playing out? Do you feel comfortable coming off your line? Which are the two kind of things that he's been criticised for. And he, you know, flat-batted both of them, said, I've always been able to do it, no problem. You know, that kind of thing.
I've just never actually done it, but I've always been able to.
Yeah, exactly. So we were like, fine, what else? You know, we can't force him to say anything else, but, you know, the proof is in the pudding, as we've seen. I mean, that it was just bizarre, wasn't it, against Brentford? The fact that, okay, you've seen that they're set up and then you still play that pass into Eriksen. And more so the kind of waiting for it to happen. You know, if you're going to take a short goal kick, just go quickly. And it's always like United seem to kind of get the goal kick, wait, okay, right, and then Brentford go, okay, they're going to take a short one, let's get in position. And then he actually kicks it short rather than even go long, which is what I think Ten Hag had kind of said he should have done and kind of trained on. So it is an interesting area. We did a piece, Dan Sheldon and I, in The Athletic last week, where we spoke about the fact that actually United are still looking for a goalkeeper. Now, all summer, they've been looking for a number three, basically, thinking that Tom Heaton could be the number two. I think Ten Hag looked at that situation, decided Tom Heaton can't be his number two for the same reasons that David De Gea really probably isn't his ideal number one. You know, this is Tom Heaton, again, very good professional, good shot stopper, but he played for Burnley in the Premier League for 6 years and, you know, playing out from the back wasn't his modus operandi there. So Ten Hag's kind of gone in, and I think the Dean Henderson interview has crystallised that in his mind a little bit. You know, he's got a guy here who's very confident, who's not afraid to say that he feels like he should have been a number one. And Ten Hag's going, well, we let him out the door sort of before I was properly in. Right, actually, we're going to change focus and I want a number two to then possibly push De Gea as number one. You know, so the recruitment side of things have now raise the budget for the goalkeeper that they can kind of go for. But it's all, again, you know, sort of 3 weeks to go, 2.5 weeks to go in the transfer window. So, but that has been another change where, you know, it looked like they were going for one direction and now they've actually, you know, decided, okay, we've got to go for a higher band of goalkeeper.
Yeah. The other issue, Laurie, at the moment is the is what always happens when things go badly at United. It's the ownership questions sort of flare up again. And, you know, we played earlier the little exchange between Redknapp and Neville where, that you know, Neville seemed to want to talk about the ownership and Redknapp wanted to talk about the game. And I found myself kind of on, you know, disturbingly on Redknapp's side, just because while these ownership conditions are obviously terrible and we kind of know about all these long-term issues, I don't see why that should kind of invalidate discussion of how the team, the manager, whoever, the people who are there, completely make a mess of an individual game such as they did at Brentford. The question here though really is, do you have any reason to think that this situation might be about to change in the short term? Because the Glazer family have always been unpopular owners. They've always been bad owners. They've always just made loads of money. They've just been making money the whole time. And I don't really understand why they would want to change that situation. Do you think do you have a different expectation? Do you think actually something might be about to happen here?
You hear rumblings. You hear the suspicion that people are, you know, gathering together and thinking this could be a time to strike. I mean, you know, the fact that the Super League failed, that was their kind of escape through the trapdoor of United's value is going to rocket here, and then we can cash out and make billions and billions. They might only make billions now, I suppose, if they sold the club. There's perhaps two more ways that they could raise the value of the club when you look at selling media rights individually rather than collectively with the Premier League, the broadcast revenues, and then also something to do with NFTs or the metaverse or something. I mean, it's above my head, but that's apparently the two different ways that United could go back to that, you know, incredible valuation that I think they were aiming for. The Chelsea thing has change the landscape a bit. You know, that went for more than people were expecting. So I think, what, $3.5 billion was it? So clearly the Glazers would want more than that for Man United, even though the share price is, you know, down on what it launched at 10 years ago. And the fact that sort of that suggests that the value of the club is declining. I don't know what they will do. Every time we ask, you know, the idea is that, you know, Joel is committed to the club and the family, you know, don't want to sell, but they do keep, you know, cashing out shares little by little. They're also doing a fan share scheme. We'll see the substance of that in due course, but that's something that to kind of keep an eye on, I suppose. The supporters organisation are very keen to have that have real teeth, I suppose. But I mean, in terms of the Redknapp and Gary Neville debate, I found it compelling television, I have to say, just because I think you have to admire Gary Neville's passion, and he was informed on the subject. And I also admire Jamie Redknapp kind of pushing back quite a lot, you know, and you're right, you know, you obviously can't absolve a manager and the team from a 4-0 defeat at Brentford. You know, you have to scrutinise that, absolutely. But also, at what point do you then broaden out the conversation more widely to talk about the owners, because ultimately it all stems from their takeover of the club and how they run the club and the people that they put in place, irrespective of the amount of money they spend. Well, it's the club's money that they spend, obviously. So I kind of feel like, why can't they have that kind of discussion after a 4-0 defeat? Because when else are you going to do it? On a sort of Tuesday afternoon when you've got nobody else watching, I feel like that's the prime moment to kind of get that kind of conversation into the public conscience. And yeah, everything stems from them in terms of the people that they've put in place. They haven't hired best in class. Decisions they get involved in, and that leads to deadlock on progressing the club in certain ways. I mean, you know, the Super League provoked them into talking about stadium redevelopment and the training ground. You know, we're still kind of, that's years away that anything like that is going to actually be seen. The proof is in the pudding. Joel Glazer now does speak to fans via a sort of not the fans forum, he did that once, but he's got the fan advisory board that he speaks to. He's spoken to them twice. That should be a continuing thing where he can actually hear from fans about what they think about the club. But again, you know, what does that ultimately mean, you know, on the ground? I think people would just like to see a club hiring best in class, where you've got real debate between people in the recruitment team and the football structure, rather than have, you know, a kind of drift that seems to be going along with your Man United at the moment.
Laurie, Dion, thanks so much, and happy Premier League 30th birthday to you both.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers, guys.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's a beautiful summer's day. The breeze is stupendous.
Stupendous. Stupendous.
Would this podcast be even more stupendous without ads?
Without ads?
Ads. If so, then join us for daily commercial-free shows at secondcaptains.com for just €5 a month.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm not bumping them up. I'm not Irish. I'm just saying my observations, they are amazing.
Stupendous. Stupendous.
There was so much going on this weekend, Ken, that I was worried you might have missed the latest example of Pep Guardiola. You know this tradition he has of overpraising players that he's about to specifically overpraising the human qualities of a player he's about to boot out the door.
Yeah,
you can think this is the kind of thing I'm talking about.
We love him so much. He's a special person for all of us. He's so nice.
So nice. Yes, that was Pep on the irreplaceable Sergio Aguero, who he had already decided to replace when he was making those comments. Pep has produced another one to add to the genre, talking about. Do you want to have a guess who he's talking about?
Well, if you're saying that it's to do with players who might be about to leave, I'm wondering if it's about Bernardo Silva.
Yeah. It's about Bernardo Silva, who's linked with a move to Barcelona. Pep was asked about him during the week. 110% I want him to stay. I love him. I go weak when I talk about him. He is a special person. I don't know what is going to happen, but he knows how much we like him and want him and love him.
Sorry, is this D.H. Lawrence again?
I go weak when I talk about him equals give us another 10 million, Barca, and we might have a deal.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think he means it, actually, about Bernardo Silva. Like, I think he genuinely does love... Well, like, I don't know if he loves Bernardo Silva, you know, as a human being, but I think he loves him as a player. Although, you know, again, you know, it's like... wasn't Diego Torres saying Bernardo Silva's been pissed off since Pep started leaving him out? And he did leave him out a bit, which sort of... But I don't know. I mean, I feel like he should love him. I knew that he didn't really love Aguero, right? So when he was saying all that, he knew that this was
But
bullshit.
Bernardo Silva is a diminutive, skillful midfielder. Like,
Bernardo
Jesus
Silva
Christ, come on. Like, what more could he do?
He's a perfect City player. Again, yeah. I do not understand how this guy can end up playing for Barcelona this season.
Like, it's, I don't expect it to happen just because how can they afford it? Like, it's
levers.
I know. But it's, come on, it's just bollocks. Like, come on.
Say it, Kent. Say the word levers.
I'm not going to say the word. But, you know, surely, but if they do, if City end up selling him, I think it's a big, big loss. You know, which is why, again, why would City sell him now? Maybe say, look, okay, you know, this has been going on a while. You know, he's been kind of griping about this for a while. Maybe next summer. But like,
he's such a brilliant player.
You don't sell Bernardo Silva with like 10 days or what, 2 weeks to go or whatever, and expect that to be fine. I mean, obviously they've got players like, you know, Grealish could end up producing more. Maybe they've a lot of good players. Like, they've guys who can step into the role or whatever, but I don't know if they've got anyone
they
that
do
good.
And they don't. They've sold quite a few players and they didn't have much on the bench the other day, bar the obvious first two or three big name players come on. After that, there's a lot of academy and youth players. That,
well, he's got a 16-man first team squad.
14-man, he said.
14.
As in at the weekend, he said it was just 14 players. So he could be dicing. If they lose Silva and don't replace him, I think they're dicing with a serious lack of.
Listen, we've got our football back. This is what we're literally talking about. The 14 players that Liverpool played to win the league in 1979 or whatever.
In fact, they should also all be from outside Manchester, in and around Manchester.
Yeah, exactly. It's like Ireland, Scotland, Wales, England. That's it. Mm. 14-man squads.
A Republic of Ireland international would be an exotic import.
And I'll tell you another thing. Those pitches are too bloody good as well, aren't they?
It was great being back in studio with you guys.
It was tremendous, son.
You can look away now, Murph. That was an intense hour and a bit, just staring at each other. Fun, though. We just continue to do it off air?
No, let's not do that.
Thanks, Murph. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Owen. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Owen, and thank you, Karen.
Thanks for listening to the Second Captain's Podcast, which is part of the Acast Creator Network. We've loads more football coverage during the week, including the first guests in this new studio, Heather O'Reilly, World Cup winner and triple Olympic champion, on tomorrow's pod. And we're going to react to whatever happens tonight between Liverpool and Palace. That's all ready for you now if you sign up to the World Service, and you'll also hear the pods ad-free. Just have a look at signing up on secondcaptains.com.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.